The following program is paid for by Little John Financial Services. The opinions and views expressed may not reflect those of Brook Communications, its affiliates, or its employees.
This is KQEN Local Talk at 4. Every weekday, News Radio 93.9 FM and 1240 KQEN brings you local information at 4 o'clock. Now presented by Little John Financial Services. It's David Little John with True Wealth on News Radio 93.9 FM and 1240 KQEN.
All right, gang. Guess what time it is? It is time for the True Wealth Radio Show on this, the best Tuesday you've had all week. I am your host, David Lucan, and joining me today in studio is...
Matt Dixon.
And Emma Arndt.
And Emma's here, too, right? If you want to catch us on the live stream, you can. That's... Go look up Little John Financial on YouTube. We're out there, right? You can find it. And then you can see all the other stuff we've done, too. It'll also get podcasted, so you'll be able to listen to that. Mm-hmm. Today, Matt... I really am kind of excited about today's show. Yeah. I love this idea. We haven't done something like this in a while. I don't want to talk about the inspiration for it, but what are we going to go over today?
We're going to talk about some of the common I'm going to say this the nice way. I don't normally do this. I'll sugarcoat it. We're going to talk about the mistakes that investors make. And so if you're one of these people and you have a bad habit, you're going to be able to identify it. And then at the end of the show, we're going to talk about how you can fix it and become a better investor.
Yeah. And maybe you'll recognize it. I think it's actually really tricky, right? This is hard because sometimes you need to step outside of yourself and
be objective,
be a little bit more of a neutral party, if you will, you know, to try to fairly assess, are you doing this or not? Mm-hmm. Because some of the things we're going to discuss are things that I would put in the category of normal behavior.
Sure.
Right? It's pretty normal to do these things, but it doesn't make it useful or accurate or helpful for investors. So we need to unpack this. But let's give our listeners an idea of an example. What do we mean? What's something that is kind of a bad habit or a mistake that investors make that we could say, well, you know, here's an example of.
Yeah, and before we even get to an example, we got to be honest, right? Like, we all have weaknesses, even like
Absolutely.
As advisors, like as I, you know, you before the show were like, hey, let's like find 10 of the most common ones. Right. And
sure.
I was like, yeah, that's a great idea. And as I just skimmed through this list, I'm like, I can actually like put myself on here. And I'm like, of these 10 things, there's one of these that I struggle with, even myself. Right.
Okay. Like, so here's the question.
Mm-hmm. Can you like skim through that and find one where you even can say, like, I've been doing this since the 90s. And like, yeah, that one's my kryptonite.
I think that a lot of these are elements that I have had to contend with, and I've certainly contended with many. There are probably some still that I could be honest is like I.
So it, we're not completely just throwing you under the bus here,
right?
Yeah,
now,
that's
here's
what
the,
I'm
here's
trying
the trick,
to.
Right?
Yeah.
I've used this example many times on the show. The concept of firefighters versus citizens when their house is on fire,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
Now, a burning house is dangerous. When a firefighter runs into a burning house, they usually come back out alive. When a homeowner does so, they often don't. And the difference is not that one of them is in a safer scenario than the other. It's one of them is trained to know how to deal with the dangerous situation better. And that, I think, comes into play on this list today is, can you look at something and recognize where your native gap is, and might you be able to fill that gap with good training?
Yep.
And I believe the answer is yes, but we got to know what we're looking for.
Perfect. So now that we've laid the groundwork, I would say that an example of this, and this is actually probably the most common thing that I see people do, is performance chasing.
Oh, yes.
And so... You know,
hope is a powerful drug.
Oh, yeah. I mean, how many times, you know, do you hear someone say, oh, I've got this one stock and it's going to go to the moon and this is really the one. And they just fixate on it.
Mm-hmm.
And they don't. Yeah. And, you know, you mentioned we should talk about the solution to these things, too. Right.
Mm-hmm.
And so, like, what's the solution to that? Buying based on like valuations and looking at the fundamentals of the stock. That's a pretty good idea. To start there, right?
Well, I would always say the first thing that you can do is slow the decision down.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you don't have to.
If you are emotionally engaged in a decision, you need to find a way to slow that decision down so that the emotions are not driving it.
And oftentimes, by the time that you have heard about it, the train might have already left the station. Like, your neighbor's giving you stock tips. Like,
yeah, it's possible that it's too late.
Yeah.
Let me use a fun example. Pilots, they use checklists for a reason. If something goes wrong in the air,
mm-hmm.
what's interesting is you would think, boy, you better make this decision really quickly. But the answer is not necessarily the case. It kind of depends on where in the flight, but on takeoff, where there's very little margin for error, the pilot, if they're good, has gone through a checklist and has already, in their mind, prepared for emergency scenarios before they ever leave the ground.
Right.
When you're at altitude, if something goes wrong, you actually have a while before the plane gets to the ground. And so it is useful to assess the situation and make a good decision rather than to make an emotionally driven decision, panic, and you may compound the error.
Yeah.
Okay. And so think about that is what we're talking about here is you can slow the decision down and still get a superior outcome.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And if it's a decision that requires really fast timing on it, then you should have pre-gamed the scenarios already so that you're prepared for those.
Right. Right.
That's the issue. We have a saying in our office, there's no such thing as a financial planning emergency because you would have failed the planning part.
Right. Yeah.
So, yeah, performance chasing is a toughie, though. It really, the idea of somebody else is getting an experience that you're not getting, so there's the FOMO component. I don't want to miss it.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And then it's also the idea that there's this, I think, belief that because something that's going to go up, it's going to continue to go up. Right. This is the rationale of the momentum investor. Look at that. We gave it a name. Does that make it okay?
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes it works out, but not every time.
Right.
And so it kind of depends on how much hype is driving the performance.
Where's the line there? How can you know if you're making an emotional decision or an objective one?
Well, I would suggest a checklist is useful. There's some more things that we're going to talk about.
When you say checklist, are you referring to like setting a rule book almost for how you're going to invest before you start investing?
So yes, in short.
Okay.
I'm saying that. We will get to this in a little bit, but the idea of having written plans, even if you're not an investor, even traders have rules. They pre-establish the rules. It's those that don't have rules that tend to really struggle. They may get lucky for a little while, but absent rules, absent repeatable processes, there's no way to tell what worked and what didn't. You know, if you just bought something and got lucky, was it because you were talented or because you got lucky?
Mm-hmm.
How do you know if you don't have a series of rules or checks to determine whether or not that decision was validated outside of kind of using the force in your gut, right?
Gotcha.
So I like the idea, when you brought something up, Matt, valuation.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, what are you exactly paying for?
Yeah,
and what are you buying? Are you buying hype or are you buying numbers?
Yeah, because sometimes, you know, a company's not making any money. They've never made money. They've been in business for 10 years. They continue to burn through all their cash. They're diluting the shareholder by issuing more shares to try and raise more money. And you start actually looking under the hood and you're like, wait a minute. Like, even if this company hits pay dirt and their revenue soars by $1 billion in the next 2 years, you start doing the actual numbers and you're like, what does that mean for the share price?
Yeah.
And you're like, wait a minute. Like,
and you can tell a little bit of people buying a story rather than buying the actual investment.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's
a, and there's a fine balance though, right? Because sometimes you have to look at the story and you have to say, does this make sense 5 years from now that this continues based on where we're at in the world?
Yeah, and here's the goofy part about it. It's going to feel like I'm talking out of both sides of my mouth here, but sometimes the story really is longer term that it's going to work out.
Exactly.
I am not making recommendations when I say this, but I could talk about something that's been around for a long time. On this show years ago, we talked about how do you value a company like Tesla that was pre-revenue?
You know, that's the name that I wanted to mention because even now you look at the valuations on it and they're astronomical, right? Like crazy. If you look at what does the company actually make, what does it trade at? Like what price are you paying for a dollar of earnings? It's insanity. It's crazy.
Right, depending on the story.
It feels like they're pricing in perfection in the robotics.
It's
sales.
And that's
like, that's what it
feels
like.
That's the interesting pivot, is that this idea that Tesla has historically been an electric vehicle company. And then somebody will say, no, it's really a technology company. And now people are starting to say, and it's about to become a household robotics company.
Right.
So that is harder to value because part of it is the story.
And you're having to guess, does it actually play out the way that investors think that it will today?
Yeah, and you know, the skeptic in me asks the question, again, none of this is advice, by the way, but I ask the question, how many times are we going to change the story for investors? Because we started
it feels
with,
like Tesla
here's what
has
we're going to
literally
do.
Been changing the
well,
story
yeah,
ever since
like,
its
oh,
inception.
The numbers aren't working the way they need to evolve in order to justify this valuation, so let's just come up with another story.
Mm-hmm.
And that, again, that's the skeptic in me. The other, so somebody out there may say the exact opposite. They're like, are you kidding? This is a vision, and this is what you need. And we're investing in visionaries here, and that's what Elon Musk is. And I go, okay. You know, I mean, that's what makes a market, is different opinions.
Mm-hmm.
But nevertheless, the performance chasing itself, that's the issue, right? And we can think of lots of other examples, whether it be historical IPOs of, you know, can't miss it because it's going to the moon. Sometimes it does, sometimes it doesn't. There's a lot of elements like that that are, you need to be aware that, you know, sometimes you're throwing money at a story and it's more like a lottery than it is an investment.
Right.
And so if you're, and how do I know? Because some people will tell me, well, why don't we just put a little bit in there and see what happens?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. That's rolling the dice equivalent.
Yep.
So as long as you know what you're involved in, you can speculate. You are allowed to speculate and call it an investment. Let's just not chalk that up to skill when it is more about luck. You know, mm-hmm. We have this tendency to have hindsight bias, and we tend to excuse the things we did wrong. We offer ourselves grace more on the things we did wrong. We tend to give ourselves undue credit for the things that we get right. That's another element of finance that you have to be aware of, is that you can start to sort of color your own opinion of yourself. And you know, there are some out there, I'm sure, that are listening and going like, not me, I'll just beat myself up, right? But there's a lot of people that they develop false bravado too. It's this confidence is not built on reality. It's just built on a string of fortunate events and what we call survivorship bias, right? Oh, It looks like those things all worked out, so it looks like you're smarter, and therefore you start to believe it.
No. Yeah.
Anyway, I'm looking at the segment. We're running a little long here. There's a bunch more that we need to get to, but hey, we covered performance chasing.
Yeah.
So now you know the first one.
One out of the 10.
I know. How are we going to get to the rest of them? We will find out, but we got to take a break first. So stick around, and we will be right back. I'm your host, Dave Littlejohn.
Matt Dixon.
And I'm Art.
And you got True Wealth on News Radio 93.9 FM and 1240 KQEN.
This is KQEN Local Talk at 4 on News Radio 93.9 FM and 1240 KQEN.
Hey, gang, welcome back to the True Wealth Radio Show. Dave Littlejohn in studio with
Matt Dixon
and Emma Arne.
All right, and this was good. Emma's got her voice back in between. So, hey, reminder, gang, if you want to get caught up and you missed the first segment, this is available via podcast. Maybe you're already listening on podcast, but you can grab that at our webpage or any of your favorite podcast hosting services. So it's out there. Look up The True Wealth Show and Littlejohn Financial. So we are talking today about some of the common mistakes that investors make. And we need to go faster, Matt. We've covered one so far. And we
selling during corrections. There you go.
Okay, that's the next one. Selling during corrections. Help me out. What does that mean?
Yeah, basically you see a little bit of volatility. Your stocks are down. You panic. You sell. And you realize the loss. And then, a couple weeks later, a month later, stuff rockets back. And you're sitting there kicking yourself like, why did I just do that?
Yeah. Panic selling is one of the most problematic things that investors could do.
Yeah.
Now, interestingly enough, are you suggesting that one should never sell when the market is down.
No, sometimes it's strategic, right? Like if you want to harvest a loss, we've talked about that on the show, where you're like, you know what? My outlook on the company has really changed. Like, I don't believe in this company the way I did a year ago or 2 years ago. They've changed the mission of the company, or their client base has changed. I'm out. That's one thing. But if the company largely remains the same and you liked them a month ago and it's down 10-15%, do you really want to abandon the ship?
Yep. I think that people get short-sighted on what amounts to moves in the froth of the market. It's not necessarily indicative of long-term value. It's indicative of short-term movement by trading. And I've seen people, their emotions get the best of them and they panic sold. Now,
my favorite is like when that stock, the fundamentals are actually improving. You know, yes. We've seen that before where the company on paper actually looks like it's getting better, but it's sliding. It's like, oh, the company's down 20%, but everything looks better than it did back when I bought it, 20% higher than today. And it's like, well, great. Now the steak looks even juicier. Let me take a bigger bite.
Yeah. So here's one caveat that is unrelated to that situation that I do want to point out for folks, though. If you are an investor and you decide that you would rather have your money working somewhere else, it may be okay to make a lateral move if you think the other opportunity is superior. The issue there is that you want everything to sort of be down at the same time, right? If I'm moving out of one thing that's down into another thing that's down, it's just a lateral move and perhaps some tax loss harvesting. However, the thing that you want to avoid is, let me sell the thing that's down and go buy the thing that's up.
Oh yeah.
Okay, that can be pretty harmful, because what you're really doing is the opposite of what of buy high, low and sell high, right? Mm-hmm. You're going to sell low and buy high. And so that can be problematic. Again, maybe you're a momentum player and you're going to buy high and sell higher, but you need to be careful that you could be allowing your emotions to wag the dog, right? That's a problem for a lot of investors, is that they end up making poor timing decisions, which is another one of our elements here, is that, you know, market timing is a problem. We'll discuss that later, but they make these decisions because of the emotions, and then they're mad later because the very thing that they cashed out is the thing that's the next winner. Got to remember, once things go on sale, that's when they get attractive to investors.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, are you abandoning something out of pricing panic, even though the underlying outlook for that investment looks positive?
That actually ties into one of the other points that we made, which was like confusing activity with progress, right? A lot of people just want to... They feel better if they're always trading or making a new position, or,
yeah,
oh, let's go ahead and take profits here. But a lot of people don't think about the even just the tax ramifications of constantly buying and selling, right? Long-term capital gains versus short-term capital gains, for example.
And this can cut both ways, incidentally, but more often than not, it cuts where you just start swapping stuff around because you feel like activity is somehow creating a benefit.
Mm-hmm.
And investing is not the same as trading. Right. I think the markets taunt people into becoming traders instead of investors. And all that means really is your time horizon goes from yearly, you know, multi-year time horizon to days and weeks.
Yeah.
You know, you compress that time horizon to the point that, oh, this is becoming my job, is trying to swap in and out of stocks and make smaller profits more rapidly, and I'm going to stack these up. Okay, well, you're now in the business of hustling stocks.
Mm-hmm.
And that's harder than you think. Long-term investing is easier, in my opinion, because you allow time to do a lot of the lifting for you, and you don't have to make the decisions quickly and driven a lot often by emotions rather than data.
Right.
You know, you're Trading value is easier than trading hype, I think. So,
yeah.
Again, I'm making a lot of like statements that sound like they're absolutes, but they're opinions. But I think it's hard. Do you remember the example of the beer? The guy pours the beer.
Yeah.
And says, you know, there's foam and then there's beer. The beer is the value. The foam is the market hype.
Swinging up and down.
And the problem is that you pour it into a glass where you can't tell which is which, right? He pours it into a solid-sided glass where you couldn't see what was in there. All you could see is the foam on the top. You have no idea how much is foam and how much is beer. And it's like the really good investors have this ability to discern how much of it is beer that they're purchasing versus foam.
Mm.
And I, you know, maybe you're not a beer drinker, and that's fine. I still think the analogy holds. You understand how much of this is am I buying foam, and how much of it is the actual discernible product.
Put it on a scale. Weigh it. Use fundamentals.
Yeah. That would be one way to do it, right?
There you go.
It's like, you know, figure out how deep is it and how much does it weigh, and you can get a sense of volume, right?
Right.
You know, that's the whole idea. There are ways to figure out how much beer is in there.
Mm-hmm.
Good. Do that.
Yes.
Take your time to figure it out.
Yeah, that goes back to looking at valuations, fundamentals.
Yeah.
And a lot of people have no clue because they don't look. They just look for a story.
I see that a lot. Or if they do look, they don't really know what they're looking at.
Mm-hmm.
And so this is the problem, too. Confirmation bias, this idea of, well, let me go look for the things that prove me right.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a hard one, right? I think we all can suffer from that is I prefer to be right. So let me go find the details that support my argument.
You know, the one that I think is really dangerous and probably the easiest one to accidentally slip into is the category of the person who falls in love with a stock.
Mm-hmm.
For whatever reason that is.
The sale-proof stock. I can tell you the story about this, but what do you mean by fall in love with the stock?
Can I give you an example?
Please do.
I know someone who worked at Costco, and they thought it was the greatest store of all time. And so
and I don't even know that I disagree with him.
Yeah.
I love Costco.
Yeah. And they're like,
the store. I don't care about the stock.
They're like, I love the stock, and or I love the company, and therefore I just want to own the stock, and it doesn't matter what the valuations are. I don't care. I don't want to look. Just give me all of the Costco stock that exists. And I'm just like, well, that's a pretty big bias, right? Like,
mm-hmm.
You don't care about the numbers under the hood. You worked there and you thought that they were great. So you're fully in. I'm like, well, you just fell in love with it and you quit looking at everything else. You're emotionally attached.
Yes.
And that also happens, though, like when someone has a really big win. And I think you talked about that earlier. Like, oh, well, I've made money on this stock over the last 10 years. It's been a really good investment, and I'm just going to hold it forever.
Let me tell you a story about the sale-proof stock.
Okay.
This is something that's called anchor bias. And I like to use the example of everybody out there, if you're listening, how much should a Snickers bar cost? Now, depending on your age when you were a kid, you have an idea of what a Snickers bar costs.
What should it cost?
Like $1.50.
That's the number I had in mind.
Okay, and so for me, a Snickers bar was 40 cents. That's the age gap, just so you know.
Wow.
And there are people that like a Snickers bar was like 20 cents or 10 cents. And you go, huh, well, I've anchored to the price from my childhood. I know there's no such thing as a 40-cent Snickers bar unless I'm getting the fun size in a big package. So the point, though, is I emotionally set a price for what it ought to be. You all did as well, right?
Mm-hmm.
10 years from now, that's still kind of the price in your mind, even though we know better. But inflation will change that. So think about a stock where, let's say I buy a stock and I spend $100 for it. And then the stock falls to $20. And what people will say is, well, I can't sell it now because I'd lose money. So what I'll do is I'll hold it until it gets back to $100. And it could take years. And then finally, after 7 or 8 years, the stock gets back to $100, and you go, great. Well, is it time to sell it now? And they go, are you kidding? Now it's making money.
Yeah.
So they just keep owning it. Yeah. So like, congratulations, you made the stock sale-proof because you insisted on the purchase value as your relevant data point, and you couldn't make any decisions outside of that.
Mm-hmm.
And how many opportunities might you have given up along the way because you were just anchored to that price? And so that's something we call anchoring bias.
Yeah.
So anyway, I think it dovetails into that concept of falling in love with the stock.
Mm-hmm.
You know, in this case, maybe you didn't fall in love with it, but you got stuck because you got attached to a price point that made you, for whatever reason, you were unwilling to sell the stock. And keep in mind, there are lots of strategies that you could have sold half of it.
Mm-hmm.
Could have kept it, sold half of it, and then split the opportunity. You would have diversified and given yourself a different opportunity set to perhaps recover. But people don't always operate that way. They do the, you know, I'm quoting in the sky, right? They do the normal thing, even though the normal thing may be the inaccurate thing to do. Or may, if it's not inaccurate, I want to call it wrong, right? It's just not going to be efficient. It's not going to be financially efficient.
Yeah.
So, yeah, people do it all the time. So we got more on the list, don't we?
We got lots.
Okay, we better get to them, but we also got to take a break. I'm looking at the clock.
Don't make us do it.
We're going to grab it. If you want to stick around, we're going to continue to talk about common mistakes. You can figure out which ones of these are mine And how can we stop doing that? That and more when we come back. I'm Dave Littlejohn.
And Matt Dixon.
And then this in the corner, too. And you got True Well. On News Radio 92.9 FM and 1240 KQEN.
This is KQEN Local Talk at 4 on News Radio 93.9 FM and 1240 KQEN.
Welcome back to the True Wealth Radio Show. Dave Littlejohn in studio with
Matt Dixon
and Emma Ars.
All right, Emma. So we've got, so you made a really interesting point, and I'm going to call this out, not to call you out, but I think it's really relevant. You work in a financial firm.
I do, yeah.
And we're talking about some of these things. And what did you say to me?
I mean, I don't do any investing or trading. I'm not an advisor. But if I did start today, I guarantee I'd make every one of these mistakes because it just seems like such a human thing to do.
It's normal, right? Yeah. What is normal? So let me give you an example when I say this. Everybody, this is what's normal. Normal is if you were willing to gamble, and many aren't, but if you were and you played blackjack and you sat down at the table and on the first hand you hit blackjack and doubled your money. So let's say you had a $10 bet and now you have $20 on the table. Normal would be for somebody to say, okay, well, I'm going to play the next hand and lose. And then I'm going to decide to walk away and say, all right, well, I lost the house's money anyway, no big deal. Right? I came in with what I started mm-hmm. with. I played the hand. I won one. I lost one. I broke even and I walked out. And they would say, that's fine. And they would say, I lost the house's money. But that's actually not true. They lost theirs. Once you win the money, it belongs to you. And that is another sample. What people are doing is they're mentally accounting for the money different and saying it's and making it okay to lose it because it was one money that they won that they didn't have earlier. So that mental accounting makes it hurt less to lose because they walked away with what they started with. But in reality, they had $20. They could have walked away and had twice as much as they started with. So it's normal for people to do the mental accounting, but it's not accurate. That's the issue, is that that's what behavioral finance studies, is the idea of the relationship people have to money, how decisions get made, and how people will frame these decisions to make it okay. I can't tell you how many times I've seen somebody that says, well, I have this account over here that's really risky, and this account over here that's really conservative. And so I don't care what happens to the risky money. And I'm like, but it's all money in the same bathtub, right? If I put hot water and cold water in one bathtub, I get warm water. And so if I lose the money over here, it's money I no longer have. So the mental accounting isn't necessarily accurate. Now, where it can be useful is tax buckets because they behave different. Now it's not just mental accounting, it's strategy differences. But a lot of people just do weird math because it makes them feel better, but it doesn't actually make them more successful. So that's what I mean about, you know, weird behavioral psychology of folks trying to figure out how to justify, oh, I've got money in a cookie jar, so therefore I can blow this money over there. Okay. Not the same as I'm going to go with a budget to a casino to gamble and that's my fun money. And once it's gone, it's gone. Like, okay, you really did make a budget and that's what you did. You stayed for a certain amount of time or a certain amount of money and that was it. Okay, you stuck to a plan. By the way, Matt, what was one of the things that we say people do with investing that is a problem? They don't have a plan.
Nope.
So did you notice how the person that had a plan walking into the casino mm-hmm. was different than the person without a plan?
Yeah. The person without a plan just keeps playing until they're either too tired and want to go home or they've burnt through all the cash.
Right. Well, and they let hope drive the strategy.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
then what did we talk about earlier? Performance chasing? Hope.
Yeah.
Right? Hope the next hand will be better. Okay? I can assure you of one thing. Casinos don't operate on hope. Mm-mm. The house knows the odds and they're going to play the hand the same way every time. And if they play it enough times, the odds are in their favor, they're going to win out. And not only that, their behavior is infinitely predictable. It's the gambler that will make the mistake with their behavior and make their odds worse most of the time.
Right. Yeah.
So as investors, people oftentimes conflate investing and gambling. I don't like it because I don't think that's the same thing. But the successful investor is all about removing variables and improving outcomes because they make good strategic decisions.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. If you've ever heard of a professional gambler that seems to win a lot, what do? They modify their behaviors to tilt the odds in their favor.
They just keep doubling down.
Right? And what do casinos do? They kick them out when they figure it out. They're like, oh, yeah, you figured out how to beat the odds? We can't have you here.
Yeah, like if you play by a a strict set of rules,
yeah,
they notice.
Yeah.
You get booted.
Yeah, they won't let you stay because they're like, oh, that's not good business for us. You're gonna win.
Mm-hmm.
So that's how that works. So, okay, what are – back to our investors and our listeners are saying, great, thanks for all of this backstory on behavioral finance. How does this apply to me? What are some other mistakes that people need to watch out for?
I would say you're reading all the headlines and that's helping you make your decisions, right? You're just reading, you pull up your phone, what's the stock news of the day? Oh, that sounds good. I'm going to make a decision based on that. So you're letting headlines drive things. I think the better idea would be to ask yourself whether that investment, like you said earlier, is that something I want to hold over the next 2 years or something? Like, yeah, whatever your time frame is, ask yourself that question.
Well, and let's say that you do see a headline. Does that automatically make it a problem?
No. Absolutely. But don't chase the headlines.
Right. Don't it see what happens. Notice how a lot of these connect to each other. There's sort of a behavioral connection pattern. Said, I let the headline drive my decision, which leads me to letting my emotions drive the decision, which leads me to try to attempt to time the market, which then leads me into short-term performance chasing, and then the potential of selling during a correction. They're all connected.
And then, the next one, you just jumped us down the road to the next one, which would be lack of diversification. Because when you start chasing and you are trading all the time, what happened to your portfolio? Before you know it, you could be 90% invested in real estate stocks or tech stocks or whatever it is. Like, you could be really overly concentrated because you got your eye fixated on something and you just kept going more and more in on it.
Well, and my sense is that what lack of diversification does is it also kind of, it drives you back towards being a trader, whether mm-hmm. you realize it or not. Because you're kind of betting all or nothing. Right?
Yeah.
It looks more like a speculation because when you're super concentrated, let's talk a little bit about something that's not often talked about on air, but I'm going to try to break it down for everybody so it makes sense with an example. We don't talk about standard deviation very often,
mm-hmm.
right? And probably because it's a statistical measurement and people's eyes roll back in their head. But there's a reason it's relevant. And let me try to boil it down to like something that's going to make sense. Let's play a game where we're going to flip a coin. Okay. So Matthew, if you and I pull a coin out and I'm going to flip it.
Okay.
We basically have 50-50 odds of heads or tails.
Right.
Okay. So heads is a win and tails is a loss. Then your standard deviation is basically 50.
Okay. Right?
Now, if we flip that coin twice, what's the probability that you get both heads or both tails?
Two coins?
Two flips. One coin, two flips.
One coin.
Doesn't matter. It could be two coins and we just flip each one. It's the same difference.
Say it again.
If I flip a coin two times,
mm-hmm.
what's the chances that I flip two heads in a row?
That would be 25%.
Okay. Now you're if what we just said was that you're going to have a 25% chance they're both wins,
mm-hmm.
you have a 50-50 shot that one of them is a loss and one's a win, and you have a 25% chance they're both losses.
Right.
Those still aren't great odds to me.
Yeah.
Right? Because about 3/4 of the time, I either split or go down.
Right.
But if I flip a coin again.
Three times. Mm-hmm.
Now I can have, what's the probability of three heads in a row? Not that high.
1 in 8.
But the probability of three tails is also 1 in 8.
Mm-hmm.
But a split of heads and tails actually improves.
Right.
Now, if I flip 20 coins, the chance of flipping 20 tails in a row or 20 heads in a row is pretty low.
Mm-hmm.
So you're going to get a mixed bag. That's the idea of standard deviation and adding diversification. More samples means fewer chances of an adverse outcome. said in layman's terms, right? If I flip the coin more times, you're less likely to have all losers.
Right.
If I pick good investments, I should be walking in the door with better than 50-50 odds to start.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Good investments, I probably have more like 90-10 odds. Like 90% of the time, over time, it makes money. 10% of the time, it doesn't. Then you go, okay, how many do I need to own so that if one of them goes bad, it doesn't take me out? And the statistical number is somewhere between 20 and 30-ish. Again, I'm not giving formal advice here, but I'm saying from a standard deviation perspective, more than 30 positions, the standard deviation doesn't change very much. Mm. When you go from one coin flip to two, it's a huge jump. You go from 50-50 odds to like 25 odds, right? So, or I guess 35%. So we'll go from 50% to 35. That's a big gap. If you flip it 10 times, right, you know, your standard deviation gets cut a lot. At 30, you're way, way down. But at like 100, your standard deviation is actually not that different from 30. Statistically, they start to become almost the same number because of the way math works out. And so, nerdy stuff. But the idea is you need enough diversification to protect from something going wrong. And your point, Matt, was people stop being diversified. Yeah, because they start trading. They start owning one or two things,
yep,
and betting the farm on it. And your diversification goes out the window.
Well, and when you're saying diversification, is that just in like the number of different businesses, or because I hear you talking about like industry diversification too, like not
it's,
all
it's
being
all
in
of
tech
the above.
Or
you know, it's a sneaky one because it's kind of like if I buy Home Depot and Lowe's, am I diversified? Like, well, technically you own two different companies, but they really walk and talk a lot alike.
Yeah.
So you're not getting as much diversification as if you owned like Home Depot and Boeing, right? Those are pretty different industries. Airplanes and home improvement are not that similar. Yeah, if the economy sucks, they both feel it. But they're pretty different companies.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's what diversification is. And it's also low correlation, right? It really wasn't something on our show to cover here.
Yeah.
But diversification needs to always be evaluated through the lens of correlation. Correlation is the magic, because if I buy all tech stocks, oh yeah, I'm diversified in that I have lots of positions, but they all are in the same exposed area of the market. If something goes wrong in tech, it hits all of them. So it's kind of like, well, do I put all of my houses in the Florida Keys? When a hurricane comes, it hits all the houses,
yep,
right? Or do I put some houses all over the country, and when a hurricane hits, the other houses are less affected? They're affected like, well, insurance went up everywhere because Florida's expensive. Yes, it does affect the market. But the hurricane only blows one house down, not all of them.
Yeah.
Makes sense to me.
There you go. All right, so let's talk about the last segment here. The setup is, how do we become a disciplined investor,
mm-hmm,
and avoid these things? And you know how?
Yeah, I do.
Yes, you wait until these commercial breaks are over, you come back, and then we will tell you.
You're going to give them the keys to the car?
I'm going to give them the keys to the car, the keys to the store, all the keys. It'll be awesome.
Okay.
All right. We'll be right back. Stick around. I'm Dave Littlejohn.
And Matt Dixon.
And I'm Art.
And you got True Wealth on News Radio 93.9 FM and 1240 KQEN.
This is KQEN Local Talk at 4 on News Radio 93.9 FM and 1240 KQEN.
Hey, gang, welcome back to the True Wealth Radio Show for the home stretch. I'm your host, Dave Littlejohn.
There's a math test at the end of this, by the way, for everyone
this
listening.
This one, all right, we'll put it out there for everybody because this is kind of cute. The question is, and so the answer is that using gaming theory, the answer is not the same, but what's the probability of having three heads in a row if you flip three coins versus flipping three coins simultaneously and getting all three of them to be heads? And is it a different probability?
Okay.
And my take is,
chat us on
my
YouTube
take is
live,
that it's the same, except that in theory, if you are flipping coins in sequence, there's gaming theory suggests that the probability of flipping three things in a row simultaneously is probably lower than flipping all three coins and having that. But I don't even know that it's statistically measurable. Like, the sample size is probably too small.
Okay.
Doesn't matter. Let's focus on our investors, right? They're all like going to Google trying to figure this out.
I'm just writing notes.
And I'm over here going, I think we're looking at the wrong question here, because none of our investments should be 50-50 shots. We should always be picking investments that have a lot better odds than 50-50. Otherwise, they're no longer investments. We're speculating. The question is really, how do investors avoid some of these common psychological mistakes or unforced errors?
Okay.
So if you were going to be talking to somebody, and let's say you've got a young investor that's just getting started, and you want to teach them, what should you do to avoid these? What would you counsel them?
Well, first of all, just go ahead and call a financial advisor, get their take on this.
he would make a sales pitch. Got it.
Yeah, of course I would. So the firm is Little John Financial. You can find us at littlejohnfs.com, or you can call or text our phone number at 541-375-0898.
It is his job. I can't give him that hard of a time. It's like, yeah, you know, it's ultimately, you know, it's a radio show where, hey, you know, if you don't have an advisor, we know them.
Hey, if you're not doing one shameless plug a show, then you're just not doing your job.
Yeah, you're
right?
Just not ABC, bro. Right?
For the low price of $19.99, you can call today.
Well, let's say that we've got folks out there that aren't interested in doing it, that are interested in doing it themselves. Like, if you're not a DIYer,
okay,
like,
I can shed some light on this for you.
But for the DIY person, what do they need to know?
I'll be serious for you for like less than 2 minutes. How about that?
Okay, that sounds about right.
We have to really ingrain this in people's minds, right? And you talked about it earlier. If you don't want to make mistakes, write out the playbook before you ever put a dollar into the market, right? Like, what is it that you are trying to do? I did this recently with some of my own personal money, where it's like, okay, how much do I want to have liquid if I need the money for whatever reason? So I established a baseline where it's like, well, that much is going to be in some liquid cash alt, right? Mm-hmm. Like, I can get to it. It's making me some interest. Cool. How much do I want in a growth style stock? Big names, stuff that you recognize, stuff that I believe in long term. Pick a percentage of the portfolio after that. Okay, do I want to have some, in my mind, what I call defensive positions? Stuff that even when the economy or the market looks sour, maybe those positions are going up or those companies are still making money. What percentage of the portfolio do I want to be those positions? And I established a set of rules. So I think I would encourage everyone listening, if you're going to be investing, maybe do the same thing, right? Like, know what you're about, know what you want to do, and then go do that thing.
It sounds remarkably like having a financial plan.
Oh, boy. Oh, boy. You just had to use those words
there
on air.
We went. Well, you know, the financial planning is this amorphous term.
A lot of people think it's really complex and scary and crazy, and it doesn't have to be, I think is what you're alluding to.
And it can be modular. Like, there can be parts of it that have complexity. I mean, let's get honest. If you have a lot of financial moving parts, taxes get pretty nuanced.
Mm-hmm.
So planning through that tax gauntlet can take some work in order to be strategically savvy and efficient,
mm-hmm.
right? But your retirement plan may not be as complicated as you think. It's like, well, I kind of want a lifestyle about like this. It takes about this much money to do it, and I want it by this time. Well, that's the math. Mm-hmm. You figure out what rate of return do you need, what kind of contribution should you be making, and then you design an investment strategy that you expect to return above where it needs to so that you can get there. Right? You know, you don't build a strategy that says I need a 10% annualized return and I'm putting it in CDs at 2%. I'm good. Right? No, you're not. You know you're going to fail because the numbers were never worked.
Right.
So the first step is, okay, let's establish what are realistic expectations. But that's some basic math. It's not radical stuff to get your retirement plan tracking well. But a financial plan that says, okay, well, now I have the math for the retirement. What's the engine?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, okay. Well, that's nuanced because the investments take a little bit more work, right? There's some moving parts to that.
Mm.
Okay. Well, what about risk management? oh, you know, I hadn't thought about that. I'm married. I got a couple of kids. I don't want something to happen where something happens to me. You know, everybody's like selling the house and trying to figure out how to make ends meet. So, yeah, you might need to look at some life insurance and some other risk management factors in your life.
Yeah.
Okay. Those are all reasonable. Oh, we have a house with a mortgage. Yeah, you probably need to have homeowner's insurance. You're going to drive. You probably have car insurance. Okay. Yeah, that all gets incorporated into a plan.
You know, one thing that you kind of jarred my mind to, you asked, like, if the person's going to DIY, what do they need to do? Mm-hmm. Another big one, I think, is don't forget to check your accounts, right? Like, I can't tell you how many times someone's like, oh, yeah, you know, I created this thing 4 years ago. I'm like, well, what did you buy in it? I don't remember. It's been 4 years ago. There was no rebalance. There was no refresh. There was no look at the investments.
Yeah.
They just said it and completely forgot about it. And it's like, oh, like, you've owned the same three stocks over the last 20 years, and you invested it based on what you thought 20 years ago. Sometimes that works out great. Sometimes it doesn't.
It can work. I mean, 20-year time horizons for stocks is often pretty good. The question is, could you have diversified and created superior opportunity?
Right.
Could you have managed taxes along the way? Because a lot of people forget, if you buy something and it's not in a retirement plan and it grows and grows and grows, I've seen people that refuse to sell things because now they have giant tax liabilities associated.
Yeah.
So you can make things structurally harder to work with because you didn't pay attention.
Yep.
And if it sounds like, we're talking out of both sides of our mouth, we're not saying you need activity just for the sake of activity. But you don't want to become...
Optimize around taxes.
Yeah,
how about that?
I would say you don't want to become so disengaged that you introduce negligence into the equation too.
Correct.
So those are biggies. I think if we just said it starts with a little bit of intentional strategy, a little bit of planning, a little bit of discipline, and then the awareness that the common mistakes, you need to know what those look like so that you can ask yourself, am I making these common mistakes? And the big trick is slow down first. Slow down, try to assess without using your emotions as the yardstick. And say, well, do the numbers make sense? Would I still want to do this? Does the story jive with reality? And if you'll do those things, I think you improve your odds a lot. Obviously, we can't guarantee anything here, but I still would say, yeah, do that. And you're much more likely to be successful than if you just wing it.
Okay, someone's listening to the show right now, and they're itching to talk to you personally on your cell phone. Go ahead and give them that cell phone number.
Yeah, I'm going to give them our office number, and Emma can help find me. It's Little John Financial. It's 541-375-0898. You can also go to littlejohnfs.com and get lots of information. But that's it for today. We got to run. So until next time, thanks for tuning in. I'm Dave Littlejohn.
Matt Dixon.
And I'm Arndt.
And you've been listening to True Wealth on News Radio 93.9 FM and 1240 KQEN.